Hi, everybody. My name's David A., and I'm an alcoholic. And we can get this thing from falling. And only because of God's grace is America of Alcoholics Anonymous am I sober this day, and for this I am so thankful. Well, anyway. And my role this morning would be to share AA's experience, and this alcoholic's experience in the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. As I said yesterday, that no one speaks for Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. No one has been so designated. No one is so authorized. We're simply asked to share our experiences, not our opinions, because we find as a result of our experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous that opinions in many, many instances have a tendency to make sick people sicker and in some instances to physically kill people. The greatest gift that we have is our experiences. Now, we hear it all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous, that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others recover from alcoholism, which is nothing more than a combination of Tradition 1 and Tradition 5. The only requirement for membership is desire to stop drinking, Tradition 2. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions, Tradition 7. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, institution. Tradition 6 does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Tradition 10. Our primary purpose and the only reason and the only business that AA is in business, and that is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. It has no other business. Now, you know, every alcoholic who comes to AA today is automatically given three gifts or three legacies, the legacy of unity, the legacy of service, and the legacy of recovery, and the legacy of unity, and the legacy of service. This was not so when AA got started. It only had one legacy, and that was the legacy of recovery. And as AA began to grow and began to explode, particularly after the Jack Alexander article in 1941 in the Saturday Evening Post, and people were beginning to, in AA those days, it was tremendous. They thought they were flocking to the bookstores to buy books. And the membership was beginning to grow, and also along with that were becoming a lot of problems. Whole groups were getting drunk. Groups were trying to become all things for everybody. And all things, and all people. And in the middle 40s, why, they went to Bill, and the drunks then says, Bill, do something. And so Bill sat down and wrote 12 more points. And as Bill began to, and then, which were evolved in our 12 traditions, and in 1950 at the first international conference, they didn't even call it convention, it was conference in those days in Cleveland, the traditions were adopted by the membership of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so it became our second legacy of unity. And very implicitly throughout AA's traditions is the admission that our fellowship has its defects. Now, that's not hard to understand because we're composed of 100% defects. There are no well people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we admit that we not only have character defects as a society, but these defects threaten us continuously. So the traditions are simply nothing more than a guide as a result of experience to better ways of working and living, and they are also the medicine for our various group sicknesses. And don't think groups don't get sick. Whole groups get sick. Whole groups get drunk. In the early days of AA, there was a group, and they didn't have any women in it. And they only had about 13, 14 members, and they were all males. And one time, and they got a phone call from a gal that was out in a tourist court. Now, back in those days, that's what they called them, before they called them residence inns and motels and everything, tourist court. And she was drunk. And they didn't have any women to go make a 12-step call on her. They were sober in AA, so one of the gallant blades decided he's going to go out there and 12-step her. But 2 days later, he hadn't come back. So they sent another member of the group to check on him and the gal. And they got out there and found both him and the gal drunk. And the one they sent out to check on this first one, he hadn't come back. So they sent a third one, and they found out three of them drunk, and they didn't come back. And this went on and on and on until they only had one member left in the group. Sober. And he got tired making, you know, telling himself his own story every night to me. So he decided to go check up on the group. And he found them all drunk, and he said, well, as long as they're drunk, I might as well get drunk. He got drunk. The whole group got sober. Started all over again. And so as a result, you know, the 12 traditions are to group survival and harmony what AA's 12 steps are to each member's sobriety and peace of mind. But the 12 traditions also point straight at many of our individual defects. For by actual application, they ask us for personal as well as group sacrifice, and that is the toughest thing sometimes, to put the common welfare of Alcoholics Anonymous before our own personal selfish desires. And they're all the traditions just simply ask us to never use the AA name in any quest for personal power, distinction, or money. The traditions guarantee the equality of all members and the independence of all groups, and this is tremendous because it allowed the groups not only... When we get AA, we have a way to live, to be free. Free of alcohol to begin with, and then free of our own stinking selves. And the AA groups are free because due to local geographical customs and things like that, in order to grow. And one of the saddest things is members of AA go out and they're going to start a new group. And it's going to be just like exactly the group that they came from, even though they got mad at the group and started another group. And there ain't no thing, it's just like two people in this world. There are no two people in this world that are absolutely alike. If they were, one would be useless. And so it gives the groups the freedom and the autonomy to do these things. And as a result, they show us how we may, the traditions show us how we may best relate ourselves to each other in the outside world. And they indicate how we can best function in harmony as a great whole and for the sake of the welfare of the entire Society of Alcoholics Anonymous. The tradition just simply requests that every member, every group, every district, every region, every country in Alcoholics Anonymous shall lay aside all desires and ambitions and unwanted actions that could seriously bring serious division among us or lose for us the confidence of the world at large. There are hundreds of thousands of members of AA who do not realize the integrity that Alcoholics Anonymous has generated in the leaders of heads of states, also educators, also religious leaders, the business world. They don't realize what they think about us, as that is for our principles and what they stand for. Maybe some of our individual members they don't care too much for. But AA as a whole, what it's all about. And you know, Eve touched on something last night. And she, when she said that Bill was so excited and that he had a visitor from the United Nations, a delegate from a country, an ambassador. And the country was Greece, because they had used the principles of the traditions in the Greek relief effort. And it worked so well, because it knocked out personalities. And it got down to the true source of the common welfare of feeding people and not putting money in the pockets of the black market and things like that as we know today. Now, as you're talking about the heads of state, many, many years ago, when the United Nations moved from San Francisco to its present headquarters in the East River at the foot of 45th Street in New York City. And as Eve said, the office that was in on 45th used to overlook the United Nations building. But this is back when they first moved, and the then living former president of the United States, Herbert Hoover, was there to deliver a very important policy talk. And right in the middle of the policy talk, he stopped. And he made a 180-degree turn. And he says, you know, if the world would live by the most perfect set of principles that he has personally heard about, seen about, read. And if the United Nations would operate under those principles, that this would be the finest world that God would ever know. And he says the principles of those are Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there is no known documentation that Herbert Hoover was a member of AA or any of his blood kin or emotionally attached or members of Al-Anon. However, and for a long time, they didn't realize, even our archivists didn't know where this came from. And I've been talking about it for a long time. Well, it's real simple. It's been under their nose all along. In one of the earliest conference reports, Bill talked about it. Bill talked about it. But I wanted to dig deeper. And so, you know, are active in AA or try to be, eventually have a lot of spies. And there was a gal who got sober in our group and moved to New York City, and she went to work for the sales department of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. Now, I managed to get a hold of the invitational list of those guests that were invited to the dinner given at the Union Club in New York City in February of 1940 by John D. Rockefeller, Jr. on behalf of the early fledgling Alcoholics Anonymous. And the drunks took it, and they were actually going to solicit those people because they were all tremendously wealthy people, bankers, you know, and investors and friends of Mr. Rockefeller. They used to call him Junior. That's how personally they got with each other in those days. And so as a result, they were going to hustle all of these rich people for some money. And they'd make comments after them. This one is tight. This one is religious. This one is loose with his pocketbook. And right after one of them were these words, perhaps Herbert Hoover's best personal friend. And so I got this gal when she was up there to get the old records of the Waldorf Astoria, knowing that Herbert Hoover was living in the towers of the Waldorf Astoria after he left Washington, D.C., and to find out what was going on. And she called me back and said, found the old records and found on what floor and what suite Herbert Hoover lived in. And guess what? She said, David, his best personal friend that you asked me to look up lived in an adjoining suite. And that's where Herbert Hoover had found out about Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, while he's making this policy talk, television in those days was in its infancy, and of course radio and the newspapers, the magazine, were the most popular news media, and the radio was on, and there was a bunch of drunks sitting around, members of AA, doing nothing, you know, buying railroads and airlines, you know, when they get ready to leave, hey, loan me a dollar to buy some cigarettes, you know, or get some coffee. And when the two words Alcoholics Anonymous come out over that radio, and he kept talking, the drunks looked at each other, say, wait a minute here. We're the only ones that know anything about AA. That's an A. Let's go up and tell Bill. So they borrowed somebody else's car, and they borrowed some money for some gas and cigarettes and coffee, and off they go up to Bedford Hills. And they get up to Bedford Hills, and they get up there, and Bill, now here's the house, and then the garage, and then up this little hill was Bill's sort of retreat where he did all of his writing with a big picture window, and he'd look out at the trees and everything and his desk. And they come running in there, and meanwhile, the story had changed from the time they left downtown Manhattan till they got up to Westchester County, up to Bedford Hill. And they come running in there, and them drunks' eyes were as big as Coca-Cola bottle bottoms. And Bill says, what's up, boys? And they said, Bill, you won't believe this, but AA's best friend, old Herbert, he said, old Herbert who? And he said, they told him who it was. He said, the best friend AA's got. He said, I didn't even know really he'd know too much about AA. He says, oh, yeah, Bill. He was down at the United Nations. And he was delivering this important talk, and he stopped, and he said, you know, the world better live by the principles of AA, or the world's going you know where. And Bill, being a real drunk, and Bill could get excited. He could get carried away. And you know, I was fortunate. I was 5.5 months sober. And a former delegate wanted to go visit the General Service Office, and he'd been in the conference, and one of the early conferences. And he wanted, and so I didn't have any money, and so he financed me to go. bought me the ticket and bought me two pairs of nylon drawers, you know, you wear one pair and wash the other dripping dry in the bathroom. And off we went. And that was one of the greatest things that happened to me, because at that time, I met your speaker last night. And I've had a love affair with her now for going on 25 years. I met her at a Thursday night, and she was lithe and active and up at the Lenox Hill Group in New York City. That's, they call it the Silk Stocking Group. And there she was up there and just moving around, and everybody seemed to know her and everything else. She'd already retired from the office. And then the next greatest thing was we went to the office the next day. And I met the staff and a grand gal, Hazel. And Hazel smoked cigarettes all the time. And it looked like to me everybody in that place smoked cigarettes. And they walk in the little office, and it wasn't bigger than this podium here, really, and that no head with one arm Lasker Award thing hanging in there, and a statue, little statue in there. And we went in and introduced to Hazel, and then we got to talking, and Hazel said, "Would you like to meet Bill?" Oh, my God, I thought, out here's the head llama. Well, this is right when, as Bill Caesar, but it really was the AA Way of Life, and then the title was changed as Bill Caesar. It had just come out in 67. And this was at Bill's, the intergroups, and it was Bill's 33rd sobriety anniversary dinner. And so Bill was in there autographing some of them for some of the people that come from, members of AA come from out of town to go to the dinner. And so Nell Wing was in there in her little desk, and Bill's was over here, and here's the door, and Bill could sit and look at the door. Nell was there, and he said to Nell, "Why don't you leave? This is going to be a meeting for alcoholics only." And then he sat down, and he says, so after we introduced him, "Oh, you're from Dallas, Texas?" He says, "Yes." And then Dallas had a very, very warm spot in Bill's heart, because that is where Ebby ended up, Bill's friend and sponsor. His longest period of continuous stretch of sobriety was at that in our area. He originally sent him down to Odessa to Ralph and Jones and his wife, and out on a ranch out there, and I tell you, Ozona, Texas, rather, and it was close to the Mexican border, and Ebby loved to drink ale. And he'd slip over there and get drunk, and Ralph just wore Ralph out, just dragging him out of jail, so they moved him back to Dallas. And the reason he ended up in Dallas, that there was a Charlie M. who was a AAWS director, and he was in the import-export business, and he had married a gal who used to be a buyer from Neiman and Marcus in Dallas called Madeline. And they got married, and anyway, and they had this close attachment, and this was here. And he asked about the drunks in Dallas and certain ones and et cetera and et cetera. And Bill, physically, if you've never met him, and of course Eve is familiar with him, he had a long turkey neck, and he smoked. Bill never did quit smoking. He just quit buying, that's all. He never quit smoking, just quit buying. And he'd smoke, and God Almighty, he had a real alcoholic cough. Now, it would start at his toenails and come all the way up, and then have an aftershock as it tapered off, you know. And this is right when the miniskirts came out, but the micro minis came out. And Bill was sitting at the desk in his door, and then you'd have go down the hall, and they had a conference room at the end of the at the end of the hall. And so we hear this clop, clop, clop of heels. And Bill could see it, and I turned around, and here was this beautiful blonde lady, and she was a member of AA from California, and she's wearing one of them micro mini skirts. And she was well enamored, and when she walked, everything about her jiggled, you know. And after she passed, Bill looked, and he grinned, and he says, "Son, AA is in good hands." And right there and then, I knew that Bill was a human being, that he wasn't a guru, he wasn't a llama, he was just a drunk. That's all. Just a drunk. Just a drunk. And that was a wonderful experience. But to go back to the story, meanwhile, so even Bill got excited. Oh, my God, Bill got excited. And the drunks say, Bill, we're the only ones that know anything about AA. We're going to run the United Nations. Now, can't you see a bunch of drunks running the United Nations? You turn on your television set in the morning, and this face comes shattered out, you know. Good morning, world. My name is David A., and I'm an alcoholic. And we're down here at the United Nations this morning. And we're going to open this moment, this meeting with a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer. And for you civilians out there in that world that do not know the Serenity Prayer, the words will come along the bottom of the screen. And after that, we're going to read a portion of how it works from chapter 5. And the ambassador from Iran is still having a tough time understanding how it works. We're going to ask him to read it one more time. Now, the agenda to be discussed among the nations today will be honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And we're going to ask you to return to your television sets at 5 o'clock this afternoon for a very important news special. Because we understand from a reliable source that the ambassador from Iraq is going to take his fifth step with the ambassador from the United States. And even Bill got excited. And then Bill said, hey, wait a minute, boys. Wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. They estimated at that time there were about 9.5 million drunks in the world. He said, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. Now, we've got all we can do to take care of our own kind. We're not all things for everybody. Now, to go back to the heads of state, you know, Russia has always had a tremendous problem with alcohol. But Russia, at one time, had the best way to sober up a drunk for life. They used to shoot them. But they're losing a lot of people due to the explosive growth of AA behind the Iron Curtain. Now, we didn't even know that they had regular grassroots groups behind the Iron Curtain, because all we'd get is reports from people in the Foreign Service, and they'd be locked up in the embassies, members of AA, and they never got out into the grassroots of the countries. And we didn't know it until one of them showed up at the interim World Service meeting in Frankfurt, West Germany, in 83. And we didn't even know it. We didn't know it. And it came from Warsaw, Poland. And they had 25 members in this group. Now, AA has been in Russia for over 36 years. In fact, the big book was smuggled into Russia one page at a time by members of Alcoholics Anonymous from the Baltic countries, Norway, Sweden, and Finland, working on construction jobs. It's just like churches. It's been there all those years. They just never did broadcast it a lot. In fact, we have had in our General Service office portions of our literature translated in Russian. And they've been there for over 30-some-odd years. And they were the basis, believe it or not, of some few pamphlets that they wanted to get into Russia just a few years ago when all this publicity came about creating a sober world. Now, isn't that something? God is having a tough trouble doing that. How are a bunch of drunks going to create a sober world, you know? Yeah. And so, as a result, they don't realize it. And so when they begin to hear about AA growing, they being having diplomatic relations with Finland, and they knew that the Finnish National AA Convention was going to be in Helsinki in that particular year, then some members of the Politburo were asked if they would go and see what is this AA all about. Because they were getting rumblings out of Bulgaria and Czechoslovakia and Hungary. And so they went, and they sat, and they listened, and they came back. They were asked, what is this AA? And they said, you know, that's the darndest thing that we have ever witnessed or heard. He says, you know, those idiots say that if you don't take the first drink one day at a time, there's no way in the world you can get drunk. They said, Unbelievable. Then they said, well, who pays for it? They said, you won't believe this either, that they are self-supporting through their own contributions. He says, you mean the government doesn't pay for it? No. Then they were asked, could it work in Russia? And they said, we believe that it can. And they said, well, how would it work? They said, real simple. You want to be a drunk communist, you want to be a sober communist. Well, AA works like that all over the world. You want to be a drunk alcoholic or a sober alcoholic. But once we understand the malady, the illness, unfortunately, unless if we've got it, unfortunately, until we find and after we lose the power of choice, we're going to drink unless we find a way to get choice out of the way. Because we're not in the picking and the choosing business after we get sober and alcoholics not. And so, as a result, and AA is exploding, and it certainly is, and you know why it's exploding? Because it's stuck to the only business that we know, and that is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. Achieve sobriety. AA is, and I could talk for hours about all of these things that are so interesting and vital. One little minor item, AA got to Mexico, one of the finest non-alcoholics, AA has been in Mexico for years and years and years. The first Spanish translation, and even remember this, is old Charlie, who's down there in Puerto Rico. He's the first one, basically, to translate, and in those days, they didn't send anybody up to the office or send the manuscripts in to check it. They say, well, just do it and tell us how you did it. Send us a copy and go about helping drunks getting sober, you know. And because these were in the early days when they were groping. And one of the finest non-alcoholics friends that A's had in Mexico was who attended the International Lawyers Convention in London one year. And he sat next to the gentleman from the United States. The gentleman from the United States says, would you like to go have dinner with me this evening? And then, it's fine. And the next thing you know, the gentleman from Mexico found himself and his friend from the United States sitting in an open AA meeting. And the friend from the United States asked him, he said, how do you like this? He said, this is wonderful, wonderful. I've never heard anything like this. The gentleman from the United States says, well, would you like to go to another meeting? He said, I sure would. They're a lot better than these lawyer meetings we're going to. And so the gentleman that sat next to him was our own Bernard Smith, who is also a well-known international lawyer. And it's through him that his friend from Mexico got interested in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, what can I do when I get back to Mexico City to see what I can do as a non-alcoholic, as you are a non-alcoholic, and with your helping Alcoholics Anonymous in a meager way? And he said, why don't you call him and ask him? And that particular lawyer in Mexico City has been and is the chairman of the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous at the present time. And it is a tremendous thing. We had the World Service meeting in San Juan del Rio, Mexico, in 1982. And a call came from the delegates from South Africa. And they were at Bob P. at that time was our general manager. And they were telling Bob that they couldn't come because Mexico had severed diplomatic relations with South Africa because of the black and the white situation. They couldn't come. And meanwhile, while this telephone conversation is going on, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous came up to go to the archives to look up something and came up to the 8th floor to say hello. To say hello to Bob. And Bob saw him and just motioned him in, told him to have a seat, and he did. And when it was over with, he said, well, I guess you want to know that about you. You can only hear my end of the conversation. And he explained to him exactly what it was. That member left, and that member went back to his job. At that particular time, he happened to be the second highest ranked full-time paid employee at the United Nations. And he went immediately into the office of the ambassador to the United Nations from Mexico. And he walked in unannounced. And he says, I have something I need to talk to you about. He says, you know, for some way or other, you found out I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you said that you had a son that was a total embarrassment, not only to your family, the family, but also to Mexico. That he was strung out on alcohol and everything else and thought he was Batman trying to fly off the Empire State Building. Now, I didn't ask you if he's black or white or green or skinny or fat or ignorant or cross-eyed or blind or deaf. I didn't ask you if he was a leper, if he had polka dots. I just said, where do you think we can go find him? That'll take a presidential order. I don't care what it takes. Get it done. You asked us to do something, A, to do for you. Now, we're asking for you to cooperate with us. You're not being honest. So hesitantly picked up the phone. And he called the authorities down there and said, wait a minute, this is going to take a presidential order. So he went in to see the president. And at that time, they had devaluated the peso and the banks were closed and they were running around, troops around there and everything else. And the president, Portillo, said, wait a minute. He picked up his phone and he called his good friend, who's the chairman of the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous, also an international lawyer. He says, why didn't you tell me that this most prestigious meeting is going to be held in Mexico? He says, you know what I think about Mexico? I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the finest thing we've got in Mexico. They don't have their hand out begging the government to feed them. They take care of their own kind. They're getting sober and families are getting back together through Al-Anon. He says, you know what I think? He said, well, I didn't want to bother you with all this political turmoil that you're having. He said, hang up. And he called his aide in and he says, you call the General Service Office in New York City, and you tell them to contact them delegates that they are free to come to Mexico and not only come in but leave. And he says, and I also, he says, we have diplomatic relations with Holland. Have them fly to Amsterdam, clear immigration and customs, and come directly to Mexico City. I am cabling a presidential order right now. And that's how they got into Mexico, because of the respect of what AA and the impact that it's had in the lives of people all over the world. All over the world. And so the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous stand as a sacrificial character of our life together and their greatest force of unity that we know. And this brings us to tradition one. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Basically, we could knock this tradition out pretty quick. Common problem, common solution, common recovery, common father, the oneness of one. Probably no society in this world today sets a higher value on the personal welfare of the individual member than does Alcoholics Anonymous. But long ago, AA found that the common welfare had to come first. For without it, there could be very little personal welfare. Our individual sobriety depends upon the group, and the group depends upon us, and that's live and let live. And unless we curb our individual desires and ambitions, we can damage what the unity of the group. The group has to be unified in doing only one thing, and that is the recovery program. And then follow up with all the traditions and anything else that has to do with maintaining our existence and our being. Now, I like to use practical, actual experiences. And our brother or sister, the noisy drunk. You'd be surprised how many members of Alcoholics Anonymous and how many groups today have not seen a wet drunk come to their first meeting. And if you want to perk your group up, you bring in one of them sloppy wet drunks to his first AA meeting. God, it perks the group up. And they get sick and they mess up the floor. Then you know what the floor is there for. And then, you know, we used to bring them, and I still go to them. Oh, I loved them. I still bring them to their first meeting wet. And, you know, and we used to group come in, too. We'd put them on the front row. That'd be a hopeless row, you know. And then we'd put two drunks on either side of them so they couldn't jump out sideways. Then we'd put another drunk behind them so if they fell back and couldn't hit their head on the floor. And then we'd get the biggest sober drunk in the group and turn his chair around and Let him sit facing that drunk so he couldn't jump out. And then we'd say, well, who's talking tonight? Oh, no, no, that was too religious. Let's get somebody to talk about, you know, that's got one of those real barn-burning drunk stories, you know, the kind that he drank for 30-some-odd years, and, you know, and he shot the police, and he killed the cat and the dog, and he run the wife and the kids out, and he threatened the employer, and he stayed drunk, and then he woke up one morning about 35 years of drinking and realized he had a little problem with alcohol. Get one of them kind. And so they would. And he'd get up and tell one of them horrendous drunk stories, and that wet drunk would say, oh, you don't know anything about drinking. And somebody says, shut up. Well, you know how a wet drunk answers you when you tell him, shut up? Make me. And we said, shut up. You know, and meanwhile, way back in the back, somebody would say, you know, you can't talk to that brother drunk like that. That's one of God's kids. Somebody said, how long you been sober? 30 days. Shut up. You know. Nowadays, not all of them, but nowadays there's a bunch of these 30-day wonders we got. Hey, you can't talk to them like that. If you do, they say, don't you talk to me that way. I'm going back and tell my counselor, you know. And guess what? That alcoholic, that wet drunk on the front row is in hog heaven. Here are people who are actually fussing with each other how to best take care of him, who are actually thrilled because he's drunk and he smells bad. They're thrilled he's drunk. And he just came from a bunch of people out there who were fussing at him because he was drunk. And that's the difference between them out there and us in here. And when we let them out there start telling us in here how we should do, then we might as well close the doors. Close the doors. Yeah. And so, you know, and sometimes if they insist on disrupting the meeting, you got to ask them to leave. Sometimes you have to call the police. And there's nothing wrong calling the police to come to your AA group. At least the police find out where drunks meet. Yeah. And so as a result, so we're putting his common welfare first. But it's his or her welfare if he or she is ever going to get sober. But the group must go on functioning, ready for him or her and others to come. But that's only one of the rare aspects of the picture. When we get sober in AA and we begin to lose and throw off a small bits of our big ego, for we admit, well, I can't handle alcohol, but I can't stay away from it on my own. Fine. But then we find there's still plenty of that big ego. Sometimes it leads us into taking other members' inventory or to gossip about their supposed shortcomings. I guess I'm the only member of Alcoholics Anonymous in this meeting this morning who is guilty of that, you know. Or it may lure some of us into hogging the discussions at every meeting, you know. And, you know, you see them all the time. They're always chairing the meeting. They're always doing the talking. They're always doing the reading. They're always doing collecting the money. They're always telling somebody what to do. And nobody can get a word in edgewise. If that's happening in your group, you know how to stop it. It's real simple. If you're asked to do something in AA and you turn it down, don't gripe at the ones that are doing it. Because it has to get done. It has to get done. And so, you know, back in the old days, you're talking about they didn't have any women in AA. And God Almighty, and when the first woman got sober, which was Florence Rankin, and when Florence got sober, they just knew that AA is going you know where. And Florence got sober at the time that, pardon me, got time at the sober when they hadn't named the big book. And my God, they had considered over 100 titles. The big book. And she came in and there and they didn't, and you know, and they were going to, first they were going to call the first 100 men. And Florence Rankin had a woman alcoholics fit. She got up and she said, you will not call it the first 100 men. You will call it the first 100 men and a woman. And they say, we will not. It'll make the title too long. Well, let's have a vote. They voted her down. Then they were going to call it A Way Out. Then they're going to call it A Way Out. So Fitz Mayo, who lived in the Baltimore, Washington area, when he was going to go home one weekend, they asked him to go to the Library of Congress and see how many Way Out books that were in print. And he sent a telegram back and said there were 12. Well, that would make AA number 13, and they thought that the numbers 13 were unlucky. So they still hadn't named it, you know? And even though they considered over 100 titles, and it really narrowed down to the 100 first one of the 100 men, and then they were going to, but something else came in the picture. And you know, AA then is like it is today. We still got members in AA today. They had them then. They think that AA will heal everything and everybody. Just bring them in. Get this spiritual recovery program. You got worms in your navel, wax in your ears. It'll take care of that. Don't worry about it. Well, it just so happened there was a member of the Manhattan group, and only one group in Manhattan group. And so, as a result, the Manhattan group. But he had a friend. The friend had a lot of money. But the problem of it, the friend was locked up in a maximum lock ward in an insane asylum in Connecticut. Now, this was the founder and the publisher and the owner of a very prestigious magazine. It's still in print today. And so the drunk got to thinking. You know where it says in portion of chapter 5, there are those too who suffer grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. So he figured if he can get that drunk out to that meeting and maybe crack him to where there's a little honesty, that he'd reach into his pocket and bring out his checkbook and write him a figure for 7 figures, over $1 million. And by God, that's drunk thinking. And so he cons the superintendent of the insane asylum, plus the head psychiatrist, and he brings him to the AA meeting, and he puts him over in the corner. Well, in those days, Bill used to lead the meeting, and he'd sit in the middle of the floor. That was Bill's favorite. If Bill had a floor to sit on or a wall to lean his back on and cross them long legs, he'd do it. And he loved to tell yarns about Alcoholics Anonymous. But he used to sit in the middle. And he had a 3-legged sewing stool and a round seat. And he'd take the leg and he'd point. You time to discuss. Later on, that little 3-legged sewing stool with the round seat evolved into what we know as our triangle and circle, or our logo today. And while this was going on, the insane person in the corner was mumbling, and he was disturbing the meeting. So Bill said to his, go over and tell your friend to quieten down. He's disturbing the meeting. So he goes halfway over, and guess what he was mumbling? Anonymous alcoholic, anonymous alcoholic, anonymous alcoholic, anonymous alcoholic. Now, the two words Alcoholics Anonymous had been used very, very sparingly, if none at all, in the Cleveland, Canton, Akron area, but little or none in the New York area at that time. And so, they said, what about Alcoholics Anonymous? And you see, AA evolves, and we just grasp it from whatever will fit the purpose. And Bill was thrilled with the words of it. Now, you say, well, why isn't it in A comes of A's and others? Well, I'll tell you. If you're interested in reading, perhaps, some of the most accurate history of the evolvement of AA and how it got its name and everything else, there's a book with a name on it, a non-alcoholic, Lois Remembers, Bill's wife. Lois knew more about the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous than any human being alive because she was sober. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it is a tremendous history reading book. It really is. It's got a lot of things in it. And so as a result, but to go back to the unity in that group, and this is how this tradition evolved. It got so bad, they had 2 atheists in the group, Hank Parkhurst and Jimmy Burwell. But Jimmy was worse than Hank. And every time they'd start, in those days, they didn't have chapter 5 or anything else. So they'd read a portion of the book of James. Bill got that when he used to sit at Dr. Bob's fireplace in Akron, when he, after he 12-stepped, And they formed their little group out there, and Ann Smith used to read it out of the book of James. And so they'd just read something, you know, out of religious tracts or articles. And Hank and, Jimmy would jump up and say, I don't believe in God, and I don't want to hear God, and I'm shut up, and all this. And it would have fights and everything else, and it got so bad that they couldn't have a meeting. It was disrupting the unity for the whole hour. So the secretary would notify all the members of the group except Jimmy, and then move the meeting. Well, Jimmy would find them. And so they didn't know what to do. So they went to Bill. And Bill says, send Jimmy to me. So Jimmy went to him and said, Jimmy, Dr. Bob and myself are going to start an automobile polish company. And we need to have somebody to go out on the road selling it. Now, it just so happened that Jimmy had the only car in the group. It was an old Lincoln Zephyr. And a car was so valuable in those days because they could go snatch drunks, you know, and pick up drunks and bring them in and everything else. But they were willing to sacrifice that most precious commodity just to get Jimmy out of the group and out of the area, just to have some peace and harmony for the welfare of the group. So Jimmy took a job as a sales manager of a one-man sales force to sell automobile polish that never was going to be manufactured, just to get him out. And what does he do? He gets about 90 miles down the road to Philadelphia. And doing what a good drunk needs to remember, he wants to stay sober, he went and got him a wet drunk. And believe it or not, the wet drunk took the bait. And they started this little group in Philadelphia. And they used to meet in a hotel, and they'd put a blurb in the newspaper. If you're having trouble with alcohol and you want to get fixed, but it read kind of like a veterinarian's ad, come to this hotel at certain time and certain night. And they did. And there's an old gal by the name of Gladys Barnes. And Gladys got sober in between Marty's two sober. Now, Marty got sober, and then she went back to drinking. And all right about the same time, she came back. And there's a real interesting story about that, but time will not permit it, about Lois sent Bill looking for Marty. And he found her. She's coming out of a delicatessen. And Bill was there in an old peacoat, a navy peacoat with sleeves up to here. And he said, what are you doing here? And he said, I promised Lois I would find you. Yeah. But to go back to the story, and anyway, and so Gladys come up, and Gladys was an old chorus line, vaudeville dance line, high kick dancer, and she was drunker than 9 billy goats. And she come up there, and in those days they had guards stand outside the door. And only real alcoholics could come into the door, into the meeting. And so she came and says, well, I'm here to get fixed. And he says, you go over there. And she says, what's over there? And he says, well, that's where them others. What do you mean others? Well, that's the family and everybody. She says, I have a problem with alcohol. I've got this article here. And you said, if you got a problem with alcohol and you want to get fixed, come to here's the hotel at the time. I want in that meeting. You can't go in there. She said, you call me a liar? And she took off one of them spiked heel pumps and got to beating on that drunk. And she had him down on the floor. And in total defense of his own life, he looked at her and said, lady, if you want to get fixed that bad, you go in there. The guard on the door that night at that meeting was Bill's friend and sponsor, Ebby Thatcher. Ebby later became Gladys' sponsor. Gladys moved to Dallas. She's a member of our group. And she passed away. She was continuously sober when she did. A tremendous gal. And so there's another reason on the unity. So it soon became very apparent that the relationship between sexes were not going to break us up. And you know, you're talking about the common unity of the group. In the group that I'm a member, many, many years ago, there's a bunch in the group that, you know, are getting good before they're getting well, you know. They come in and they stop drinking and they quit cussing and they quit smoking and they start jogging. I've never been arrested for fat driving. I don't know about anybody else. And as a result, they had what they call in those days, and they call them Red Riding Hood and wolves, you know. And they had some Red Riding Hood and wolves in there making goo-goo eyes at each other. And this bunch is getting good over here, said they're going to ruin our reputation. We got to throw them out of the group. Well, it's very difficult to throw a member out of a group if they're sober and they're not raising too much cane. So they sat down and they wrote a letter to Bill. And they said, "Dear Bill," and they explained the situation, "how do we get them out of the group?" And Bill wrote back, "Dear group, are they staying sober? Love, Bill." Well, Bill doesn't understand the seriousness of the situation. So they wrote him a more detailed with some lurid facts in there with basically to color it up. And the letter comes back, "Dear group, are they still staying sober? Love, Bill." Well, Bill really doesn't understand what's going on. So it wasn't a question of the Red Riding Hood and Wolves what they were doing. It's a question over here what this bunch didn't think was right. That's where all the problems start in groups anyway. And so they sent a more detailed letter, and they sent it airmail special delivery, certified, return receipt requested. The letter came back, "Dear group, are they still staying sober? Love, Bill. Don't bother me anymore." And guess what happened? This bunch over here was so busy writing letters about them folks over there and waiting for the answer. When they finally looked over there at them folks, guess what? The problem had taken care of itself. And I am so thankful that in my few weeks of sobriety, that some of the older members of AA shared that experience with me, were almost word for word, which has meant to me from that time to right this very second that David's got all David can do to take care of David's business and living sober in his relationship with his Creator, and you've got all you can do to take care of your business living sober and your relationship with your Creator and the recovery program. And you don't need me sticking my nose in your personal business, and I don't need you sticking yours in mine. And that's what we call live and let live. And it takes care of itself. And so it became, but like other societies, you know, there are other forces that bother us, that alcohol and sex could not. These are the desires for power, for domination and glory and for money. They're all the more powerful. Because they're dangerous, because they invariably powered by what? Self-righteousness, self-justification, and the destructive power of anger. These are the things that we must keep always at the top. For if we do not, then we are in serious trouble in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so now this brings us to tradition true. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Oh, my God. When Bill was traveling all over the United States, literally promoting the traditions to get them adopted, and he'd come to, when he got to this tradition, and the groups would, and the oldest sober member of the group would say, Wait a minute, my group doesn't have any conscience. I'm the conscience of the group. I got them sober. I got them out of jail. I talked to their families. I talked to this or that. If it wouldn't be for me, they wouldn't have jobs. They wouldn't have a doggone thing. My God, I'm the conscience of the group. And I'll tell you, a lot of the members, older members, got awful upset about the situation. But in time, as we begin to evolve and develop, we come, as I said yesterday, about our service manual and about rotation. And we still see them in AA today, the power driver, you know. That once they get their hands on it, whether it be whatever it is, whether it be secretary of the group, treasurer of the group, they want to give it up. And so what's the dilemma? It's real simple. And so now rotation. And always remember, if we can, that our leaders are trusted servants. They do not govern. And if a group wants to be a group elects, what, a chairman or what? Now, what's a big honor in being known as a chairman of an AA group? There's no big honor to be known as the head sick, you know. But in AA, we want everybody to have a chance to be the head sick. You know, yeah. Or if it wants to be a part of the worldwide service structure, it elects a GSR, who's 2-year servitude is in at the same 2 years of the delegate in the area assembly, and right on down the line. And so, and it elects these various things, you know, whether it be coffee brewers or the whole thing. And so, and a group conscience is heard when a well-informed group is informed. It rests a lot of time just on, not just on arithmetic alone. And as I said yesterday, minority opinions get very, 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 very thoughtful consideration. One of the saddest members of an AA group who feels that the spirit of the traditions are being violated and is afraid to get up in front of the group and say, I'm real uncomfortable what our group is doing, for afraid that whoever they're sponsoring will leave them. Maybe the group will ask them to leave. Maybe their sponsor will ask them to shut up or get somebody else. And they carry this around in their gut. And always remember, if we can, that no one can punish anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the one that's hurting the worst, and a lot of times, a lot of members will get up and say this to a group, and the group, you know, well, we didn't realize that we are in that dilemma. Let's see what we can do about it. And so this brings us now to Tradition 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Now, we have to remember, in that tradition, the only requirement for AA, that first A, right to this very second, still stands for Alcoholics, not Addiction Anonymous or Addicts Anonymous, but Alcoholics Anonymous. We are, have, and are very, very still today concerned about our membership. In fact, when strong and heavy publicity first came AA's way, and even today, when there's more publicity about alcoholism than ever before, a lot of the older members became scared, and they said to themselves, won't all kinds of odd people show up who have complications, alcohol mixed with pills and other things? And in the older days, and even today, we don't hear as much today, they talk about that mythical character, you know, called the pure alcoholic. You know, no complications, just a guzzler. And in the early days, and even today, some members came in, they thought they were exactly the same way. But then when other members begin to pour in, then the older members begin to worry. Won't there be some mighty queer people? Won't there be socially undesirables and degenerates? And they ask for nothing more than smugness, you know. And this is nothing but downright fear. You know, we simply do not know who or what's going to show up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And since AA has gotten off the ground, every kind of a human being that's an alcoholic has shown up in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God. And back when they used to have membership rules, and you say, well, isn't every organization entitled to have rules for membership? Well, why did AA forego this privilege to be all-inclusive and not exclusive? And that's simple. When AA was 10 years old, all the groups that were in correspondence with the headquarters were asked to send in their membership rules. And if all of those rules had been in effect every place, everywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous, practically no alcoholic could be a member of AA. Bill and Dr. Bob never would have become members of AA. If you read Bill's story, Bill, alcohol and sedatives, and Dr. Bob, alcohol and barbiturates. And so the rule book was thrown out and replaced with one sentence, you know, Tradition 3. But then somebody would say, well, it does rule. It does have a requirement for membership. Well, let's read it again. The only requirement for AA membership is desire to stop drinking. Who in an AA group and who in Alcoholics Anonymous, any place, anywhere, has been designated by Alcoholics Anonymous to determine who is an alcoholic and who isn't? It's up to the individual. Because the agent that forces us to come to AA will either force us to stay or it will eliminate us, one of the two. Who? Now, I've been in A groups over half this world and everything. I've never been in an A group where they got an instrument where you can stick up, in, and down, and through an alcoholic to see how alcoholic they are, you know? Yeah. Yeah. Or whether they're going to get drunk or not, or whether they're going to stay sober. So, therefore, who? Only the one that can say they belong is the newcomer themselves. And we have to take their word for it. Now, I like to use actual experiences and how this particular tradition also really involved it. Eve alluded to it, the old 24th Street Clubhouse in New York City. And the door opened, and the police drug in this character. And Barry was on the desk. He's dead now. And the police drug this character in there, and they said, now, you can do more with this than we can do in jail. They left. Now, I'm going to describe it, and I'm going to call it for a few moments. I want to describe it, the character. It had on a lady's dress, a lady's hat. It had lipstick and rouge and eye makeup, had lady's earrings, carrying a lady's purse, wearing lady's silk stockings and tennis shoes with holes in it, and it was drunk. Barry looked at it and said, what do you want to do about stopping drinking? And it said, more than anything else in this world. But he said, man, let me tell you something. Oh, and it was black, too. I forgot about that. He said, man, let me tell you something. I not only been on gin, but I've been shooting with the needle, and I've been smoking that grass, and I've been taking that snow and that heroin and that horse and taking them California turns.